This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Now, Boris Johnson has been speaking today about the risks that the Indian variant poses to the unlocking roadmap. Katie, does it look as though the 21st of June is not going to go ahead in terms of the lifting of restrictions?
To be honest, it doesn't look either way right now. There's been various briefings, some on Coffee House, suggesting it definitely won't happen. But I think it's just too early to tell. And I don't think Boris Johnson's comments, which can be read in some quarters suggesting the opposite, that it will happen, he said there is nothing conclusive in the data that means England will have to deviate from the roadmap out of lockdown. Now, nothing conclusive is different than nothing. And I think previously when we've had the Prime Minister saying there's nothing, you know, in the data we're staying on course, to me this is it suggests they could be seeing some things, but until they know a bit more. But I think much as we want to discuss this on this podcast, the truth is ultimately we're just not going to know for a while. We're waiting for data to come in. I think I wouldn't say ministers seem particularly panicked, but it's also just a waiting game, because they want to see how these clusters develop, if they start to go to other places, if the surge testing starts to have an impact, if this chain of transmission can be broken up. I think, although there's been some suggestions this could take 2 to 3 weeks, I think we could know a bit sooner, actually, where it's looking in the next week or so. But until then, I think we're just going to be analysing every word. I think what's clear, probably if you want to take something from the Prime Minister's comments, is that he does not want this idea that things definitely won't happen to take off. And there is a sense that, no, we're not ruling anything out either way. You could still have a June 21st scenario.
James, ministers seem quite pleased with the surge teams that they've been sending to Bolton, and I understand there's one on its way to Bedford as well. What are they doing, and are they as effective as ministers are boasting?
They are vaccinating people, to put it simply. The idea is that if you bring vaccinations to kind of people's doorsteps, you remove one of the reasons why people wouldn't do it. And there is some anecdotal evidence from efforts over the weekend and earlier this on yesterday, but, you know, some people who are on the fence about getting a vaccine have decided to get a vaccine now because they've heard about this variant and they think, oh, okay, maybe I should. I think Katie is right in that we're just not going to know for a little while right now about what's going to happen. You can read, you know, John Burns Murdoch, the FT's data journalist, great COVID number cruncher, and feel quite encouraged that this is all going to happen. You can read Christina Pagel from UCL and think that, oh my word, there's no chance of this happening. So we're just going to have to wait until we have some more information, both on how much more transmissible it is and B, the extent to which the vaccines have broken the link between cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. Because I think it is worth stressing that if you have broken that link, you can be more relaxed about an increase in cases if it's not leading to hospitalizations and deaths.
Now, Katie, moving on, Keir Starmer is back in the news today for his attempts to be in the news. Just explain to us what is going on with the Labour leader.
Yes, this is Keir Starmer plots television makeover, story in the Times. And it says Sir Keir Starmer is considering starring in a fly-on-the-wall documentary as he tries to revive his faltering leadership of the Labour Party. I think the idea is it's a type of through-the-keyhole drama, docudrama, and we'd see a different side of Keir. We're also hearing about potentially a Piers Morgan interview with Keir Starmer, and I think we can see a general theme here, which is a leader's office, which I think has been taken surprise by the events of the past fortnight, to put it mildly, didn't quite realise they were kick-starting a chain of events that would be so damaging to the leader, and are now trying to work out how to turn things around. I think one of the things we often hear in relation to Keir Starmer is that he's quite wooden, he's not making that connection with the public. So I think they think in these scenarios that could happen. But then You also do wonder if the problem is that Keir Starmer can't really relax or isn't particularly animated, is this what's going to be bringing it out of him? And also how many people are going to tune in? But I think it does show that for all the speculation about, you know, maybe he's just not a Labour leader who's going to win, maybe he's this interim figure, and talk about figures such as Angela Rayner, Andy Burnham in terms of who could replace him, his team want to really try and turn things around before they accept that such narrative.
I have to say that when you said he was going to be on a TV makeover, I thought initially that he might be appearing on Queer Eye and that they would be assessing his wardrobe and making him drink green juices and so on. But James, this hasn't worked that well for Labour leaders before. Jeremy Corbyn had that Vice documentary. He also got cameras in to film his first shadow cabinet after a reshuffle and was recorded saying, "Seamus, I don't think this is a good idea either," and looking very uncomfortable while his spinner, Seamus Milne, tried to move people around. So this doesn't have a great track record of working for politicians who are a bit beleaguered, does it?
I think it's fair to say that if Keir Starmer thought he was cruising to an easy election victory and was measuring the curtains in the number 11 flat in his spare time, he wouldn't be agreeing to these kind of TV documentaries. They're not quite Hail Mary passes, but they're something close to it. They're an attempt to find a way to kind of communicate directly with the voters. I think there is a challenge for Starmer in that he is an organisation guy. He is not a politician long on charisma. And so the challenge to him is, how do you find a way to kind of sell that particular appeal to the public? I also personally think that very few people come out of behind the scenes fly on the walls documentaries well.
And finally, there's a row in the cabinet over the terms of a trade deal with Australia, with ministers split over whether or not there should be protections for UK farmers in this trade deal. Katie, who's on which side?
So in the camp pushing for the trade deal, you have, drum roll, perhaps not a huge surprise, Liz Truss, the Trade Secretary, and then backed by David Frost. I think that David Frost is a Truss ally. And then in terms of those sounding alarm over reports that it would make farming imports cheaper and that can negatively impact the UK farming industry, you have George Eustace, the Environment Secretary, and also Michael Gove. Now, this is a cast of characters, perhaps not including the David Frost, who is onto the scene more recently in terms of the cabinet, who've been various disputes before about farming, and I think this balance between free trade and what some would call protectionism. And I think that it's interesting in the context of the Australia trade deal, because in the past, I mean, I once wrote of it as, you know, Lidl free marketeers and Waitrose protectionists, which not everyone loved the phrasing of, but I think it got to something, which is there are some Brexiteers who almost want to have use Brexit to have, you know, recast Britain as a high standards, green leading country, and in a way, like, would set an example to the world, but therefore you need to protect them in doing so. And I think on the other side, you have your Lidl free marketeers, who I think are figures like Liz Truss, but also actually a lot of Red Wall MPs. I think Deanna Davison's, for example, the MP for Bishop Auckland, is very vocal about the push for this. And I think there is a sense that one of the bonuses of Brexit from the perspective of some of these MPs who campaigned for it is the fact that they you could get cheaper food on the supermarket shelves. I think that's something their constituents are going to want. But then, and obviously the North-South divide isn't completely correct. There are always going to be exceptions. But then I think on the other side, some Tories are representing more traditional seats. Liz Truss is one such. But some will say, well, actually, no, it's about preserving standards. I think what's interesting in relation to Australia is that we know the US trade deal, when it's discussed, is very divisive and is seen as chlorinated chicken. I think that the Australia trade deal was not seen as something that would be such a tricky thing to get through. And I think that's why those who are pushing for this do wonder, you know, if this was really to be blocked or not be able to go in the form that's being put forward to or something close to it, is the UK really going to be able to do interesting trade deals at all?
James, where does Boris Johnson stand on this?
I think if you can't sign a tariff-free trade deal with Australia at a time when Australia is being bullied by China, which is trying to essentially put an economic squeeze on Australia to force Australia to silence its criticisms of China's behaviour on a whole range of issues, then the UK should just go home as a trading and geopolitical power. I mean, it would make a nonsense of everything if the UK cannot move to sign a... And also, remember, this isn't an instant tariff-free trade deal with Australia. We're talking about bringing in over the coming years tariff-free trade with Australia. I also think it is a misunderstanding of where UK agriculture should be positioning itself within the UK market itself, or within the global market. I think that the UK should be positioning itself towards the higher end of the value chain in agriculture. It's just the nature of the UK farming industry suits it better to that. I also think lots of these fears are overblown. Take New Zealand, for example. New Zealand doesn't even use its full tariff-free quota for lamb in terms of exports to the UK at the moment. And I think if you think that the, not just in China, but across Asia, the middle class is going to continue to grow, and meat consumption is going to continue to grow, that will be a more attractive market for Australian and New Zealand farmers. Closer, higher prices at the moment, that than the UK.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Katie. And thanks for listening.